Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Everyone, I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to be talking about health and healing. We're also going to be looking at how we can help our wonderful sister station, WBAI, stay vital in the future. And we're also going to give you the latest on some of the information we have on that shooter out in Las Vegas and the new shooter as well. Both had something in common. I'll go over that. And also, there's new information from the British Medical Journal on the flu vaccine. But we begin with coenzyme Q10. As you know, Q10 is also called ubiquinol, and it is really important for providing energy for your brain and your heart. In fact, it's one way to help prevent heart attacks and strokes. But it does something else. According to some new research from the Institute of Dental Sciences in India, coenzyme Q10 helps with anti-gingivitis, effects on plaque-induced gingivitis. So in a split-mouth randomized controlled trial involving a bunch of subjects with plaque-induced gingivitis, they put a topical application of coenzyme Q10 each day for 28 days. And then they took a look at see how it manifested. And it made a big difference. Quote, promising results were obtained after the solitary application of coenzyme Q10. So, one more way that we should be using coenzyme Q10. It helps with our gums. But also, coenzyme Q10 was found to benefit patients with Lou Gehrig's disease. And I'll report something here from Elizabeth Renter from Natural Society. Quote, have you heard of one of the latest supplements to boom called Q10. Q10, also known as coenzyme Q10, is a vitamin-like substance your body makes, and you may have heard of it before. You need Q10 for cell growth and maintenance, as well as cell protection, digestion, and other body processes. But that isn't all. Emerging research shows that it may have value as a supplement in treating neurodegenerative diseases like ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease. And then it goes on to talk about all the good work that they found with this, because many scientists have tried everything they can with Lou Gehrig's disease and nothing has really helped. But this amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS, called Lou Gehrig's disease, and that's because of a former Yankee baseball player named Lou Gehrig, died from it. And the disease is quickly progressing neurodegenerative disease that begins with twitching and cramping, while ending with complete lack of muscle control. Generally, the life expectancy once diagnosed is somewhere between 2 to 5 years. And the Japanese scientists in this particular study found that treating the scientist with coenzyme Q10 after living 5 years with the disease, he was 70 years old at diagnosis and 75 when treatment began, and by that time you should be dead. But he wasn't. He was only taking 200 milligrams twice daily for 4 weeks, and then he raised it to 500 milligrams twice a day, and then then he took decreased it back down to 200 milligrams twice a day. Even in the first round of 200 milligram dose, the scientist saw notable improvements. His voluntary muscle activity and his grip returned and his weakness lessened. And this was published in the Open Nutraceuticals Journal. Quote, the marked improvements this patient experienced are promising and offer hope that treatment with highly solubilized ubiquinol, that's coenzyme Q10, may benefit patients with ALS. Additional research is needed and warranted to confirm these findings. Okay, so if coenzyme Q10 could restore some of the neurological and nerve damage done by this disease, could it show promise for other similar neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's? Now, a little personal insight. I did a study approximately 9 years ago. It was a brain study, and it was life sound behavior modification, nothing medical. If people were taking meds, they continued to take their meds. But in this one, it was a really radicalized diet, very high in polyphenols, antioxidants, enzymes, probiotics, high fiber. It was kind of like the ultimate healing input every day, plus juicing. At one point, for nearly a year, they were juicing about 13 glasses of juice a day, organic juices. And there were many supplements taken because people had everything from ALS to multiple sclerosis to Alzheimer's, Parkinson's. And there were about 32 people in the study. And the study lasted 16 months. But at the end of that, 90% of the people found that they had major improvements, some complete reversal of their diseases. It was monitored every single week by Dr. Martin Feldman, a board-certified neurologist, qualified in psychiatry, associate professor of neurology at Mount Sinai, and the author of nearly 66 articles published in the mainstream peer-reviewed literature on neurological disorders. He was just flabbergasted. In fact, I remember each week after we had met with people, we would go out and have dinner and discuss the different input that people were giving. And I remember sitting at a vegan restaurant after one of the meetings, and he just said, he said, "Gary, I never thought this was possible. I've never seen it. Why is it working?" And I said, "Well, think of it this way, Marty. We tend to be ultra, ultra limited in our approach to prevention and natural approaches to disease, and ultra, ultra radical when it comes to causing disease." "What do you mean?" he said. I said, "Well, think of it this way. Let's just say that you had some French fries. An average bag of French fries, what do you get? Somewhere around 20? And then let's say you put a teaspoon of sugar into that dessert. Now, in a teaspoon of sugar, you probably have somewhere around 500 little tiny grains of sugar. Now, none of that is good for you. The French fries are not good. Trans fats, sodium, the carbohydrate itself, the potato, is going to become so highly heated that it will change the flesh of the potato into an acrylamide, which is a known carcinogen and a DNA disruptor, increased oxidative stress. But people like the way they smell, they like the way they taste, and they don't ask any questions. But rarely do you have someone who's just eating a teaspoon of sugar or having French fries. And generally when someone is on an unhealthy diet, they don't limit themselves. Everything on their diet is unhealthy. So now the body is having to process all these toxins in a given day. And we consider that normal. So if you ask someone who's used to drinking one, two, or three colas a day, or soft drinks, how about having one, two, or three glasses of fresh juice, they seem overwhelmed. They have no problem eating 20 French fries, but give them 10 vitamins, and they think, "Oh my God, my head's going to explode. I have no time to live. I'm going to be taking vitamins all day." Well, you don't say the same thing when you're eating 20 French fries, so we're asking you to take half the amount of vitamins that you are French fries, and you can sit there and polish off those French fries in 10 minutes. So I reversed it. I call it the laws of compensation, meaning to the degree that anything in our life is out of balance, whether genetic or, let's say, mechanical, viral, bacterial, parasitic, nutritional deficiencies, whatever is out of balance, you must exceed that in rebalancing. And when you exceed it, you're creating a new energy. As no two energies can share the same space with the same intensity at the same time, so to the point that you have depression, anxiety, fear, insecurity, uncertainty, that's your dominant energy. So you're going to filter everything you think, do, and hear and say through the filter of insecurity or depression. That means that virtually all the energy that you're going to take in and process is going to be dominated by negative. Whereas if you were thinking about healthy, happy things and having imaginative ideas of what you could do with your life, with your partner, that becomes a dominant energy. And if you talk with artists, talk with musicians, talk with anyone who is in the creative field, they can create both ways. They can create when they're under stress, when they're toxic, when they're in toxic relationships, when their body's addled with drugs and alcohol, and they're malnourished, and they're not getting sleep. And they'll create, but rarely is it something that is the best that they could do. Now put that person in a happy position where they're happy, they feel relaxed, they're at ease. When you're at ease, everything relaxes. When you're stressed, everything tense is tense. You'll create, and it's completely different. So when we're hungry, we can eat something that benefits our health or eat something that actually contributes to disease. Either way, there's an outcome. So these people in the study, every morsel of food goes in their body is maximizing health. Every beverage maximizing healing. And then we've been able to get, after about 6 months, to where we're actually restoring the brain. Well, one of the nutrients in there was coenzyme Q10. Now, this study showed a man taking 200 milligrams with substantial benefit. Well, we had people taking, all of them taking over 1,000 milligrams, and some taking much more than that. Thomas, the engineer, the 70-year-old African-American engineer, was taking upwards of 3,000 milligrams. Now, I don't recommend that for the average person, but in his case, he had to create a radicalized healing. So everything he did had to be far more than what he would normally do, and hence he reversed his multiple sclerosis, as the Alzheimer's patient reversed her Alzheimer's, as the autistic patient reversed autism, as Kenny reversed multiple sclerosis. Now jump back 20 years before then. Now we're going back 30 years and back to the late 1980s. And at the Tri-State Healing Center one day, lo and behold, my editor comes in. This was just one of the most decent, intellectually stimulating people I'd ever met in my life. And he was diagnosed, unbeknownst to me, with ALS. And he was having trouble walking. He had a person helping him. And he said, "Gary, the meds are not doing anything. I'm getting worse. Is there anything you can help to do?" So put him on a protocol, and he was on that protocol for 3 years, and he made substantial improvements. Little did I know that he was a very famous person. He wrote cowboy books, Old West books, and he had a big following because some of the people were in the room with him when he was getting his IV drips. But he was very curious, so I had to explain in great detail, which was fine, why the high doses of this and that. And he acknowledged that he had had a junk food diet. He smoked. He drank. He didn't exercise. So today I would be working with him in a different way because our knowledge has expanded, and I'd be adding on many more things, including light healing and zeolites, lots of other things. But he moved out to be with his sister, and his last day that I saw him at the center, he was walking straight up. He was not trembling. He had perfect balance. He still had the condition, but not as bad. So I'm glad to see that they're starting to look at nutrients on disease. Even if it's just one scientist, it's a beginning. Also, for those of you who are familiar with olive leaf polyphenols or olive leaf fatty, that shows, and this is a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled crossover trial with 46 middle-aged overweight men who have, pre-diabetic or diabetic conditions, and they were using olive leaf extract, quote, supplementation with olive leaf polyphenols for 12 weeks significantly improve insulin sensitivity and pancreatic beta cell secretion capacity in overweight middle-aged men at risk of developing metabolic syndrome. So write it down. Olive leaf extract, 1,000 milligrams. It can make a difference. And this was a good quality study. That's the latest on health and healing. We're 15 minutes into our program. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to hear from individuals who gave themselves an opportunity to relax, to de-stress. And then you hear the outcome. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Now, to help our station, WBAI, and having raised over $50 million for them, including helping a lot of people get their health back, and that's the most rewarding thing of all, the station is in a challenge, and I think most of our regular listeners know that. I'm still here because I believe in the station. I don't believe in what some of the other people at the other stations are doing, particularly KPFA in Berkeley, who would like to see the station sold. Well, we don't want to see the station sold, so we're doing all that we can with a shrinking audience to help pay the bills. And it's a catch-22. There are not enough people who support the station in a fund drive to pay for all the premiums. But you have to get the premiums or the people won't support you. So a couple years ago, I was asked by the station manager, would I help by holding a fundraiser? So it started with some lectures, which I did, that were very well attended, packed houses, and then premieres of films and that were very successful. And all told, those raised over $100,000. And then I did a retreat, they asked me to, and the retreat is what brings me in a lot of money, and that money goes exclusively to pay for premiums. So just understand that every penny that the station makes, premiums will be purchased and then sent directly to the people. Oh, and by the way, the good news is virtually all the shipped out, I believe this week and next week, they're all being shipped out. That's good news. So here are some people who came to the last retreat. And we're going to do a retreat in the last one this year, possibly the last one ever, because I'm going in a different direction in helping people, the second and third week of April. And what can you reasonably expect? Well, phenomenal food, vegan food, juicing as much as you want all day, which is a great detoxifier, yoga, meditation, and artist healing classes, cooking classes, gardening classes, hydroponic classes, fermentation of food classes, all these wonderful homesteading classes. Plenty of time in silence and counseling, yes, lectures. I do them throughout the day. Some days I might do 4 or 5 lectures. Generally in the evening I'll do a long lecture, 2 to 3 hours. The daytime I do anywhere from 20 minutes to an hour lecture because I know people need it. People come for different reasons. And whatever the reason, my hope is that they're able to leave there with the tools they need to take the next step in their life and be healthier and happier. So our goal is health and happiness. It's just amazing how many people don't believe that they deserve it or are willing to make that a priority. They make everything else a responsibility before they make it to themselves. So here are some people who made themselves a priority, put themselves first, and they came. Please listen in.
Hello, my name is Jim. I enjoyed my week here at Garrett's Retreat. I wish I could stay another week. I learned a lot about nature and its balance and keeping things in harmony. I have a lot of tools I will take home with me as far as gardening, cooking, and exercise. And I wish I could stay another week again. Thank you.
My name is Linda Harris. It's an experience for me to be in this retreat. I take home with me when I leave here. I felt energy, peacefulness, and calmness within myself. I also experienced a talent I didn't know I had in the art class. Ellen is very good in what she does. I must thank my husband, Winston Harris, for making this possible for me. Listening to Gary Null for many years, I must thank him. I thank the chefs for delicious meals that they had prepared for us. And I'm also thank the wonderful people that we met here, and I thank Gary ever so much.
Oh, hi, my name is Michael. I just finished a one-week retreat at Gary's beautiful facility here. I'm a chef, and I was diagnosed with blood pressure, high blood pressure, several years ago. On medication, my pressure, the best I got was 140 over 80. After being here for 2 days, you know, experiencing the yoga, the exercise class, the delicious food that, you know, has been prepared by the chef, you know, on Wednesday, I checked my pressure, and it was 128 over 80 without medication. So I'm really glad that I was able to come here and experience this life-transforming experience. And I recommend this to anyone who wants to get healthy and to live a good lifestyle. Bye.
Hi, my name is Julie, and I'm here at Gary's retreat for 1 week. Everything that I've seen is so beautiful. All the classes that he has for you are just fantastic. And the chefs that provide the food for you is just awesome. And I've lost weight here. My husband told me, come on, let's go. So I came, and he said, well, it'll be good for you. Well, I've lost weight, and I really feel good, and I'm very energy, and it's just a beautiful place to be. And thank you, Gary, for having us here.
Hello, my name is Lloyd, and this is the third experience I've had with Gary on in regards to retreats. And I must say that they just get better and better. And I strongly advise anyone who wants to make a major change in life to seek the retreats out. And I'm thankful to Gary, especially for his spiritual input that has made a significant difference in my life. Very positive. Thank you very much.
My name is Priscilla Brown, and I just spent a week with Gary Knowles at a health retreat, and it was so awesome. We met so many positive people. The experience was beautiful. You saw different types of birds and butterflies. The food was unbelievable. The week with Gary Knowles is unbelievable. I enjoyed it. Thank you, Gary.
My name is Vernetta, and I am on a journey, and it was a pleasure to come to Gary's retreat. One of the outstanding segments was to be authentic, to be stand in your truth, and that was awesome. In addition to that, the people are so friendly and wonderful, and his estate is absolutely stunning and beautiful and peaceful. And in addition to that, and I can keep going on, it was the food. The food was outstanding. I was hesitant and afraid to eat vegan because I did not know it could taste so good. It is awesome. I've had a dessert that's the best I've ever had in my life because not only was it wonderful to taste, but it was healthy for my body. And Gary has been very generous in sharing knowledge. He's been very generous in giving us his book for free to read on how to live a better life. And he even shared his product and the information I am going to use going forward. And this was a positive step in my life.
Hi, my name is Susan, and I am just so pleased with myself that I made this decision to invest my time and energy and money into coming to the Gary Null Retreat. It's very easy for me to take care of others and meet the needs of others. So this was a very big change for me and a very life-affirming and life-changing changing experience for me. One of the highlights is just the opportunity, the constant opportunity to commune with nature. You are surrounded here by the most lush and lovely setting. There are animals everywhere, and there's a lot of chances to just be in nature, which I found was probably one of the most healing aspects of this retreat. And I am very happy to say that I have decided to stay a second week to really pound into my body, my mind, and my spirit a right way of living and a way of expressing myself in my future and leading an authentic life. Thank you, Gary Null.
Hello, my name is Howard. I would like to say I enjoyed my stay here. It's a beautiful place. The food is great. I wasn't a vegetarian, but I'm starting to lean that way. And my eating habits are going to go the way that they show the way we eat here. And I want to thank Gary for the wonderful time. Thank you.
Now, if you'd like to come to the retreat, again, this is a WBAI retreat. And we're helping buy, actually purchase premiums. We purchased, I believe, in the last year and a half, over 3,000 premiums. The station did not have to pay for because we got the money from the premiums and from the retreat and bought them and gave them to the station. That's good. Here's the number that you should call. Everyone is screened to make sure it's right for you. 903-881-7008. 903-881-7008. As for Luann, 903-881-7008. And that's it. I mean, join us because there probably won't be another. And also, thank you all for enormous outpouring for the new book I premiered just last week on, no, it was this week on WBAI, The Healthy Vegetarian. We had a tremendous outpouring for that, so that's also available for you. And now we're going to complete our program today by taking a look at something the media refuses to address. Why do you think in such a bitter, acrimonious, and demeaning fight between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton in their presidential campaign to become the Democratic nominee, why would he bring her into the White House in one of the most important and powerful positions? It made no sense unless you're the people behind the scenes controlling everyone. If you're the people controlling what goes on, if you're part of the deep state, it made all the sense in the world, because then you'd be getting all of Hillary's supporters joining behind you. In return, you had to get something. Just like Bernie was told, you know, whoever got the nomination, he had to sign an agreement that he would support them, which is one of the reasons that many people felt he betrayed his base by supporting Hillary Clinton, not condemning her for all of her policy positions. But when you look now, yes, the Attorney General or the Special Counsel has indicted some Russians. It's a whole lot different than originally. Oh, they swung the election for Hillary. No, they didn't. Were they prying in the election? Yeah. But we have pried in over 69 different countries' elections. Not a word about that. No, it wasn't the Russians that ended up causing an enormous amount of Americans to vote for Donald Trump. It was the loss of promises and the lies. It was the manipulation. And people finally had had enough after 20, 30 years of being promised something would be better, and it wasn't. It got worse. And so they voted for the lesser of two evils. So here is Abby Martin giving you the backstory on Hillary Clinton, and after being a strong Hillary Clinton supporter, listen carefully, because Abby Martin, like other journalists, and other journalists at the New York Times and CNN, they're highly educated, they're very bright, they have plenty of intellectual acumen, they're fully capable of doing quality research, and on some topics they do, but not when it comes to Clinton's, not when it comes to the contradictions and the hypocrisy. They've turned a blind eye. Abby Martin hasn't. She, like them, decided to see what was it about this person that we were in denial of. Here's her take on the Clintons. Please listen in.
As the circus of the 2016 presidential election grinds on, Hillary Clinton has posited herself as the candidate of the people. But not many candidates of the people have vacation homes in the Hamptons that cost $200,000 per month, or hang out with the world's billionaires. You know, it's hard to know who she really is. While once being a proponent of Donald Trump-type positions like building a wall at the Mexican border, supporting torture, and opposing same-sex marriage until 2013, today Hillary Clinton presents herself as the anti-Trump, anti-Republican candidate. There's been a lot of outrage about the impression that the establishment has already anointed her as the Democratic nominee and has carved out her path to the presidency. But like in 2008, her guaranteed seat on the throne is being derailed by the unpredictable moods of the masses and millions of young progressive voters. She continues to play her shape-shifting game, morphing her positions to try to capture the support from her opponent. But the real Hillary is still inside. In fact, every layer of Hillary's career shows why. Far from being a candidate of the people, she's the top pick by corporations to do the real job of any U.S. president. Be the CEO of the empire. And they're working hard to keep her on that path to the throne. Having been party insiders for decades, the Clintons have manipulated DC reporters, mastered the media spin, and have a well-oiled PR machine at their beck and call.
Hillary Clinton has done everything right. She has run a good campaign. She has outperformed in debates. She's raised money. She's got a great ground game.
As a Latina, I can tell you that Latinos all over the country are very excited about Hillary. Latina women are very excited about Hillary.
Knew from the beginning that when the conversation turned to foreign policy, that this was going to be when Hillary Clinton really shined. And I think that that whole exchange was probably one of her strongest moments of the night.
Undisclosed is that many of the people praising Hillary across the corporate media work at firms employed by Clinton's campaign and super PACs. It's not just paid pundits, but the reporters and owners themselves. From Chris Matthews to the head of the New York Times, a big gang of media personalities have financial and personal ties to the Clintons. But even with Citizens United and unfettered corporate funding, the establishment can't prevent an insurgent candidate like Bernie Sanders from winning with votes. Which is why back in 1984, the Democratic Party created a superdelegate process to further undermine democracy. Here's how it works. There's about 4,000 pledged delegates divided by primary and caucus results. But there's an additional 700 superdelegates that remain unpledged, meaning they can vote against the people's will to ensure nominees are handpicked party insiders. The single vote of a superdelegate is worth thousands of ours. Many of these people are current and former members of Congress, but dozens more are literally corporate lobbyists, working on behalf of every industry from healthcare to private prisons. Like superdelegate Tonio Burgos, Pfizer lobbyist and Clinton fundraiser. Or superdelegates Jill Alper, Minion Moore, and Maria Cardona at Dewey Square Group, a lobbying firm that works directly with the Clinton campaign and lobbied on behalf of healthcare corporations to craft Obamacare for their benefit. Then there's superdelegate Jeff Berman, top lobbyist at Brian Cave, and former lobbyist for the Keystone XL Pipeline and Geo Group private prisons. Berman is even paid by the Clintons to round up other superdelegate votes. This unelected nobility comprises one-third of all delegates needed to secure the Democratic nomination. And the Clintons are surrounded by a flock of Democratic Party politicians who know the career benefits of hitching their wagon to the most powerful family in Washington. And with bills cajoling, Hillary had at least 500 superdelegate pledges under her belt months before the election had even begun, a 45-1 delegate lead over Sanders. This insane Democratic inversion plays out every time Sanders crushes a state, like in Wyoming, where he won by double digits but walked away with the same number of delegates. It's not just superdelegates investing in Hillary. Every arm of the corporatocracy has been hedging their bets on her for almost two decades. Alongside media conglomerates Cablevision and Time Warner, five of Hillary's top 10 political donors since 1999 have been some of the most powerful banks: Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, JPMorgan Chase, Morgan Stanley, and Lehman Brothers. But those numbers pale in comparison to how much Wall Street firms have graciously donated to Hillary's super PAC, to the tune of $15 million. Beyond banks, every industry has been buying into another Clinton presidency. Lobbying groups for private prison giants Geo Group and Corrections Corporation of America are bundling dollars to the Ready for Hillary PAC. Hillary's also been given more money from Big Pharma than any other candidate, and received over a third of total contributions given out by pharmaceutical giants. The defense industry thinks she's good for business, too. Defense contractor employees have given her more cash than any other candidate. Fossil fuel lobbyists are also working hard to elect Hillary. Her 2016 campaign received more than $4.5 million from lobbyists, bundlers, and donors connected to the world's biggest polluters. Their investment will pay off tenfold. Hillary has been at the forefront of promoting fracking, a dangerous and destructive method of natural gas extraction. And she's much more than just a supporter of fracking. She personally created a bureau at the State Department focused on spreading it around the world with one of her major sponsors, Chevron. The Clintons sell their friendship through other avenues, such as huge honorariums for speaking fees. Much like George W. Bush's motivational speaking tour, Bill and Hillary are quick to exploit themselves for corporate loot. But they don't come cheap. Averaging $211,000 a pop, Bill and Hillary made more than $153 million in paid speeches to elite think tanks in closed-door boardrooms since 2001. In 2013, the year after leaving the State Department, Hillary made $3 million giving just 12 speeches to Wall Street banks and financial institutions. This calculates to her earning $5,000 per minute. Seems like good, honest work to me. Demands to release the speech transcripts have been laughed off by Hillary. But we don't really need to see the transcripts because we already know what's in them. Her praising banks and committing to their prosperity. Although Hillary has recently tried to appear critical of Wall Street to pander to Sanders' immense support, her fat cat banker donors aren't worried in the slightest, saying her talking points about inequality are, quote, just politics. But how did Hillary Clinton become such a political force that the empire's biggest powerhouses and establishment elites flock to her with money and support? Hillary was born in 1947 to a wealthy textile wholesaler who unsuccessfully ran for public office. She has two brothers, one a failed businessman, the other a failed politician. Both have their own history of public scandals. Hillary's first political work was campaigning for the Donald Trump of the 60s, far-right Republican Barry Goldwater. Hillary maintains that she was proud to be a Goldwater girl and writes off her support for the offensive character as just youthful ignorance. But the timing tells a different story. This was in 1964, when the Civil Rights Act was passed, after the Freedom Rides, after MLK's I Have a Dream speech at the historic March on Washington. Goldwater's campaign was an open reaction to that. Later, Hillary became president of the Young Republicans Club at her elite university. She says she later transformed, which is a common thing for Hillary, but her conservative past is more tied to her rise than she wants you to know. The Clintons' climb to prominence had everything to do with the political climate in the country. During the Civil Rights period, the Republican Party emerged as the new choice for racist whites. Reagan's sweeping victories in the South, ushering in 12 years of Republican administrations, put the Democratic Party in a panic. A younger movement within the party formed to win back the Southern vote, known as the New Democrats. And it did so through a conservative shift, canceling out hallmark Great Society economic policies and appealing to anti-black attitudes by distancing themselves from prominent black Democrats, targeting mythical welfare queens, and pushing so-called criminal reforms that targeted African Americans.
They're a new generation of Democrats, Bill Clinton and Al Gore, and they don't think the way the old Democratic Party did. They've called for an end to welfare as we know it, so welfare can be a second chance, not a way of life. They've sent a strong signal to criminals by supporting the death penalty.
Bill swept the Southern white vote on his Ending Welfare as We Know It and Tough on Crime coded racism.
We're making some progress. Much of it is related to the initiative called community policing, because we have finally gotten more police officers on the street. That was one of the goals that the president had when he pushed the crime bill that was passed in 1994. They are not just gangs of kids anymore. They are often the kinds of kids that are called super predators. No conscience, no empathy. We can talk about why they ended up that way, but first we have to bring them to heel.
Hillary Clinton tries to rationalize her support for these measures today as having unintended consequences, but they were precisely designed to target African Americans. At the helm of a right turn for the party, politicians flocked to the Clintons, which brought a new era of Democratic Party politics, adapting to the changing needs of empire. Neoliberalism was enacted through NAFTA, decimating American jobs and economies abroad. Massive deregulation of Wall Street and the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act set the stage for an economic crisis. Clinton's crime bill exploded our shameful era of mass incarceration. When the Clintons left the White House in 1999, their rise to political powerhouses was really just the beginning, despite Bill's numerous sexual harassment cases. With a plan to put Hillary in the Oval Office next, they moved to their new home state of New York, where Hillary became a senator the following year. While wealthy, the Clintons had nowhere near the money they have today. On their 1999 tax returns, they made less than $500,000. But by 2014, they were making more than 50 times that amount, reporting over $28 million in income. And that only scratches the surface of the cash supplies they've amassed. While Hillary went to work crafting a presidential resume in the Senate, Bill capitalized on his new super elite status as a former president. And the Clintons' way of cashing in on that access was by exploiting misery and disaster. In 2001, in response to a major earthquake in India, the Clintons joined the heads of Goldman Sachs and Citibank and embarked on a false philanthropy model that would define their Clinton Foundation. These development and relief charities act as an insertion needle for Western business. For example, some of the Clinton Foundation's so-called development projects in India, Africa, and Central America include forming for-profit farming corporations that exploit small farmers. The donations typically end up back in the pockets of donors, their companies getting the so-called development contracts to build up mobile networks and real estate. In the past 15 years, the Clinton Foundation has grown into a lucrative fraternity of the rich and powerful, which boasts of having projects in 180 different countries. Including its numerous spin-off affiliates, it reported total assets of over $351 million in 2013. The sources of cash for this political machine say everything about the true nature of this charity. As a nonprofit, the Clinton Foundation is not required to disclose donors or contributions. All of the funds disclosed on the website are in ranges and unspecified for what purpose. Other than a $25 million partnership with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Clinton Foundation's large donor base is a motley crew of criminal corporations and police state monarchies. Giving a gracious $10 million is the brutal theocratic kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Matching the $10 million is the Viktor Pinchuk Foundation, Ukrainian billionaire oligarch who pledged tens of millions more to the Clinton Global Initiative to, quote, modernize Ukraine while Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. Donating in the $1 to $5 million range are Gulf state monarchies Oman, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar and Kuwait, Saudi billionaire Nasser al-Rashid, ExxonMobil, Dow Chemical, Walmart, a company she has close ties to, having served on their board of directors from 1986 to 1992, Coca-Cola, Pfizer, Barclays Capital, Goldman Sachs, and Boeing, the number two defense contractor in the country. In the lower million-dollar range are such exemplary institutions as Monsanto, Chevron, General Electric, more banks, Bank of America, Citigroup, Morgan Stanley, UBS, Bank of California, and media giant Fox's News Corp. Then there's the Soros Foundation, an organization that claims to build, quote, tolerant democracies around the world, whatever that means. It's a win-win relationship, one that only continues to grow. The Clintons get massive financial support to run their machine, and their contributors get the perks of a loyal advocate in a position of power. As Hillary ascends off of this corporate sponsorship, the more favors she can grant, leading to more contributions, and so on. And while Hillary was in the Senate, these favors for her donors were numerous. Manufacturing giant known as Corning gave hundreds of thousands to the Clintons through their foundation and speaking fees. In return, Hillary introduced Senate legislation to allot hundreds of millions in federal aid to purchase Corning products. Notorious criminal enterprises Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae were also Clinton Foundation sponsors who won big by investing in Senator Clinton. She played a key role in blocking measures to regulate them, helping them reap super profits before facilitating the crash of the economy. The deal was good for business while Hillary was in the Senate, but the plan was always something bigger. After checking the box of having experience and having built a robust financial backing and political network, Hillary announced her bid for president in 2006. Shortly after her Senate re-election. She was supposed to be the shoo-in. It was her time, as they said. But then everything blew up in her face. Mass opposition to the Iraq War marginalized her as a candidate. A little-known Barack Obama was flung to the front for his rhetoric against the war, while Hillary ardently defended her vote for the war throughout her entire campaign. Knocked off a presumed ride to the White House, she flailed trying to capture a changing Democratic Party base. Her campaign was criticized for its slew of dirty tricks, including an array of voter suppression tactics mainly aimed at the youth. Most pathetic was the release of a photo of Obama in a turban. pandering to Islamophobia and the strategy of thinly veiled racism the Clintons employed back in the 90s. Obama's campaign manager, David Plouffe, said the photo was the most shameful, offensive fear-mongering we've seen from either party in this election. But none of the schemes worked. And while today Hillary's media surrogates continue to call on close competitor Bernie Sanders to drop out, back in 2008, she held out to the very bitter end, refusing to give in when Obama was the clear winner. She only acquiesced and backed Obama after a closed-door negotiation where she was promised a promotion and a path to succeed him. As Secretary of State, the rewards for her sponsors grew to a new level, and so too did donations to the Clintons. Her corruption is exemplified by the fact that 181 donors to the Clinton Foundation simultaneously lobbied the State Department while she was in charge. She used her position to divvy out repayment favors in a variety of ways. She funneled money from the State Department to Clinton friends and sponsors, like securing tens of millions in government grants for her dear friend and owner of for-profit education firm, Lorette Education, Inc. She also used her new title to help negotiate business deals between her donor friends and other heads of state. For example, she brought billionaire mining magnate Frank Giustra to meet the president of Colombia, scoring him access to pristine forests and coastline to be mined and drilled by his company. She did the same in Kazakhstan and beyond. Hillary convinced other countries to give up permits to be pillaged. In one incident, she convinced the Haitian government to issue a rare mining permit. The contract went out to a mining company that not only shells out millions to the Clinton Foundation, but her brother sits on its board of directors. She also flew around the world on the taxpayers' dime to act as a saleswoman for American corporations. For her sponsor Boeing, she made a personal pitch to the Russian government to purchase their jets. The result was a $3.7 billion contract for Boeing. The Clintons got a kickback of $900K as a giant thank you from the war profiteer. But none of these deals compare to her role as an international arms dealer. Her State Department approved a whopping $165 billion worth of commercial arms sales to 20 nations that are also Clinton Foundation sponsors, doubling U.S. arms sales to those countries under George W. Bush. These lucrative deals are undeniably rewards for paying off the Clintons. The amount of the reward directly corresponded to the amount of their donation. Her top donor, Saudi Arabia, scored the biggest, and so on down the line. Beyond the obvious step up from her corporate shilling as Senator and Secretary of State, wreaking economic and environmental havoc to line the pockets of Clinton coffers, a President Hillary puts us in great danger of catastrophic war, another fact she's proven time and again over the entirety of her career. Clinton's war record is perhaps most exemplified by her endorsement from one of the world's most notorious war criminals, the Butcher of Cambodia, Henry Kissinger. On the campaign trail, she bragged, "I was very flattered when Henry Kissinger said I ran the State Department better than anybody had run it in a long time. So I have an idea about what it's going to take to make our government work more efficiently." Yes, the relationship between Kissinger and Clinton is very close. Not only did she consult with him regularly as Secretary of State, her and Bill frequently vacationed with the Kissingers. Her other foreign policy advisors are quite similar, including PNAC founder neoconservative Robert Kagan, and even shares advisors with Republican war hawks like Ted Cruz. Her support for the criminal invasion of Iraq has come back to haunt her once again in this election, and now she's written it off as a mistake, and in one instance seemed to blame it on being bribed by George Bush with state funds for New York.
So I'm sitting there in the Oval Office, and Bush says to me, "What do you need?" I said, "I need $20 billion to rebuild, you know, New York." He said, "You got it." And he was good to his word.
But she didn't just vote for the war. She was a key advocate of it, leading a right-wing minority among Democratic Party Congress members that favored the invasion over the old tactics of empire's domination. She called for, quote, unequivocal support for Bush's firm leadership and decisive action. She spread the lie that Iraq was in violation of UN resolutions, despite the actual weapons inspectors arguing the contrary, and continued to assert Iraq had WMDs despite it being, by that time, thoroughly debunked. As the U.S. and Iraqi body count grew and complete disaster ensued, Hillary still went around the country asserting that she had no regrets giving Bush total authority to invade and occupy Iraq. In 2007, she voted to give Bush the same authority again, with a blank check to attack Iran by trying to label their military a terrorist organization, a move rejected even by pro-war Democrats.
today, Joe Lieberman, who authored the Iraq resolution, has authored another resolution, and it is essentially a fig leaf to let George Bush go to war with Iran. And I want to congratulate Biden for voting against it, Dodd for voting against it, and I'm ashamed of you, Hillary, for voting for it. You're not going to get another shot at this, because what's happened, if this war ensues, we invade, and they're looking for an excuse to do it. And Obama was not even there to vote.
Senator Clinton, I want to give you a chance to respond.
In 2008, Senator Clinton made the chilling and completely repulsive admission that if president, she would not rule out using nuclear weapons on Afghanistan and Pakistan. After her promotion to Secretary of State, she boldly planted a flag in the Obama administration to establish the Hillary Doctrine. According to The Nation, 24 current and former administration officials, foreign diplomats, friends, and outside analysts described Mrs. Clinton as almost always the advocate of the most aggressive actions considered by Mr. Obama's national security team. Of course, she joined Obama in creating and leading terrible affronts to human life and rights, like the murderous drone campaign in Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia. The program's mass civilian casualties, she says, she takes with a grain of salt. However, on other issues, she took the lead, showing how she would steer the empire's ship as she aimed for the presidency. In her book, she brags about her lead role back in the 2009 coup of the democratically elected leader in Honduras, further plunging the country into violence and instability. Also that year, when it was long clear that the Afghanistan war was an endless, unwinnable crisis, she lobbied to send far more troops in Obama's blood-soaked troop surge. When it was time to keep the promise of bringing those troops home, then Secretary of Defense Robert Gates says that Hillary argued forcefully against withdrawing the surge troops. She continues to advocate a never-ending U.S. occupation there. The same thing happened when it came to Iraq. Hillary led a minority that tried to convince Obama to leave thousands more American combat troops there, permanently. Today, she's to the right of Obama on Iraq yet again, advocating for even more U.S. troops and more combat. Then came what has been dubbed Hillary's War, a move Obama recently admitted was his biggest mistake. Oil-rich Libya is where Clinton sought to showcase her military doctrine. Masked in sinister right-to-protect jargon, Hillary is well known as the primary advocate for U.S.-led attack to overthrow the Libyan state, to feed on its resources, and hijack the Arab Spring.
As we came, we saw, he died.
She laughed about an African leader being lynched on television, his country tossed into an era of unimaginable pain. Right afterward, what everyone predicted happened. Strife from a shattered state, decimated infrastructure, and U.S. armed rebel fighters has turned Libya into a new bastion for ISIS. The scandal of Benghazi isn't that Hillary allowed Americans to die, but that those Americans were there funneling weapons to extremists in a country she had just helped destroy. And what did Hillary take away from the incident? That there should have been more American troops.
We have learned the hard way, when America is absent, especially from unstable places, there are consequences.
Yeah, I don't think it was because America was absent, but because they had just carpet-bombed the country and injected its entire government. And on Syria, she's led the push for war from the beginning. She personally joined the shame general, David Petraeus, in creating the CIA-led Friends of Syria insurgency. She was among the first and most forceful in pushing for a no-fly zone to overthrow the Syrian state. Even as recently as 2015, she had a high-profile break with Obama over the issue, and even in recent debates had to continue to advocate for it. A no-fly zone means war. It means U.S. bombing of all Syrian anti-aircraft defense systems and much more.
Well, that's a part of the story that most Americans, especially those who voted for Clinton or support Hillary, refused to acknowledge, even though every single word she said was fully documented. So that's what you would have gotten had she been elected. You see, we think of having a buffoon, a caricature, a narcissist, a very unsavory person in power. Well, you had a chance to have someone that was better than both of these, and you said no to Jill Stein. You said no to Rock Anderson. You said no to Ralph Nader. So it's not as if you haven't had a chance to vote for the best of all. But that's your choice. But at least now you know something about the truth of what you would have gotten had Hillary been elected. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.
So in love with you, whatever you